What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Deborah Feldman, author of the controversial new book, Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, a memoir. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's very, very hard to believe that this is the 500th edition of the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. We are now well into our 10th year of bringing you the best of the Jewish world on a weekly basis, and we have yet to miss a show or fail to interview a great guest. More importantly, we have explored, explained, and argued about the controversies, triumphs, and tragedies of everything Jewish in the world over this nearly a decade, and found the most interesting and accomplished Jews to interview and enjoy for 500 shows. I'm not sure exactly what to think about this accomplishment, to be honest. We usually celebrate our milestones mid-summer when we have our anniversary shows, and we'll do that this coming August for our 10th anniversary show, but 500 shows seems like a lot. In looking back over our roster of guests, and of course, as you faithful listeners know, Too Jewish is about much more than our guests, but the guests have been fabulous. Yet, it's also our interesting mavens opining about subjects around the Jewish world and in Israel, our always changing musical features, the weekly Torah talk, ancient jokes, the news of Jews around the world, and of course, my own self-indulgent monologue at the beginning of Too Jewish, plus changing features like Jewish poetry, literature, historical moments, and the like. But you faithful listeners know all that. What you might not know is that preparing each Too Jewish show is a kind of work of love, and that it continues to be a privilege to share that love of the Jewish world and its always changing, always fascinating personalities, challenges, and successes, and that there's nothing more interesting than exploring what it really means to be Jewish in today's world each week with you. Well, it's rodeo weekend out here in Tucson, Arizona, here in the heart of the West where I live, so I thought we'd begin with a Western theme this morning. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is here in Tucson unless you live here and have lived here for at least a few years. While sometimes here in the Southwest, we can get a little testy about the stereotypes of deserts and cowboys we tend to have foisted upon us, and the label of being an overgrown cow town, occasionally we actually seek out and embrace those stereotypes. Basically, in Tucson, Rodeo Week consists of a big parade, the world's largest non-motorized parade, for what it's worth, followed by, I know this will shock you, a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days to go to the parade and wear cowboy boots and hats and such, and generally pretend that we still have some connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. You know, you might not immediately associate Jews and cowboys, but it's worth noting that there were Jews even in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman Wyatt Earp's wife, well, his last one anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. And there were Jewish mayors and sheriffs and even Jewish outlaws. And, of course, those ubiquitous jeans that everybody wears around here were pioneered by a Jewish guy, Levi Strauss, a Jewish immigrant from Bavaria who came to the Gold Country in 1850. From the Old Country to the Gold Country, Levi Strauss co-invented the denims that sat on all those saddles that blazed through the Wild West. Strauss and his partner, another Jewish tailor named Jacob Davis, he didn't get his name on the pants, patented the rivets that hold on the pockets and made Levi's the preferred pants of the cowboy set. And so, in honor of all those Jewish cowboys and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before those saddles blazed, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the west with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big Short Irving. Big Short Fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread, schlepping a salami and pumpernickel bread. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked in a salt saloon like a man insane and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. The James Boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Dum Dum Irving. Big Dum Dum Dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
That was our annual enjoyment of the classic Ballad of Irving, all about being Jewish in the Wild West. Nowadays, of course, we Southwestern Jews are much more sophisticated and braver, God knows, than Irving, but some of us still wear Levi's. Just last week, a very controversial new memoir shot to the top of the news stories and the bestseller lists. It was Deborah Feldman's dramatic story of her own escape, literally, from the Hasidic world she was born into and grew up in. Her book is called Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots. Her story is gripping and powerful. Hear it when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means, nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, even THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Deborah Feldman. She's written a book that's had a dramatic impact on the Jewish world already. It's just been released, called Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, a memoir. It tells her story. Well, actually, we'll let her tell her story. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, Rabbi. It's nice to speak with you.
So you grew up in the Satmar, among the Satmar Hasidim. Can you give our listeners a little bit of an idea of, now having a different perspective, what that was like?
For starters, I didn't really get a secular education. So you hear me speaking fluent English right now, but I taught that to myself by sneaking out to go to the library and, you know, reading books secretly because they were forbidden. All English literature was forbidden, and all secular Yiddish literature was forbidden. So I couldn't even read, you know, the tales of Shalom Aleichem.
Isaac Bashevis, Singer, or Peretz, or somebody.
Oh, of course. Really, I mean, these were authors I discovered only much later, you know, to my chagrin. So, you know, I wasn't allowed to read. I wasn't allowed to listen to music or watch TV or use a computer or play sports or have a hobby. My whole life was consumed with learning, you know, religious law, especially modesty, learning skills that would help me be a better housewife, like sewing and cooking, and essentially being trained and groomed to be a housewife and a mother.
Give us a little taste of what led to your transformation.
Oh, God. Okay, so I think I had a somewhat of a sort of feisty personality growing up, and feisty personalities don't really fit well in the community, especially if you're a woman. I think that the women I knew growing up were polite and feminine and refined and quiet, and they certainly weren't very opinionated. And I was very opinionated, and I had a very strong mind and a strong will. And I think that was sort of where it all started. I think I was just sort of born a bad fit into that kind of life. And so here I was, sort of hungry for knowledge and, you know, dying to read books, but knowing that it was forbidden and feeling very guilty about it. And so it's, you know, it starts with feeling guilty about, you know, not being able to read books. And then it's, you know, it continues to, well, what else can't I do? And these are all things I really wanted to do. I really wanted to learn and get an education. And I really wanted to be able to sit behind the wheel of a car and take piano lessons if I wanted to. And these are all forbidden. You know, I could never even dream of having a normal life. And so as more and more frustration built up within me as I grew up, and then, you know, as my marriage was arranged and I was, you know, already pregnant and 19 and expected to start, you know, a gigantic family, the pressure sort of built and I couldn't take it anymore. And I just decided to break the ultimate rule, and I started sneaking out to Sarah Lawrence College and taking classes there. And at college, my world just opened up completely. And I was like, this is it. I already see that, you know, the real world out here is not the terrible place I was told it was. It's full of intelligent and wonderful and warm people who were so welcoming to me. And I said, you know, I'm done. I'm ready to leave. And the people at Sarah Lawrence were so supportive of me, and they helped me do that. And so here I am staying.
It's a very interesting and complex story. We'll hear a great deal more about it and a little bit more about the Satmar Hasidim and kind of your, I guess, escape is really maybe the right way to put it when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 30th to June 10th. If you're interested in coming along on this fantastic journey to Israel, email 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and how to sign up. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We have a talk coming from an Israeli journalist. Let's talk a little bit about the press in Israel before we talk about Ilon Vilan's talk. Israel has a remarkably and vigorously free press, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Having that said, we need to remember that Israel is very small. So when you have only 7 million citizens, your ability to have a lot of variety of press is a bit limited. And the interesting element, and that element is the element that makes me believe that it is a free press, is that when you talk with different reporters from different parts of the press, each one of them claims that the other side is controlling the press. So that gives me a good feeling, you know.
If everybody thinks everybody else is controlling the media, then nobody is controlling the media.
Exactly, exactly. And Alon will be coming actually tomorrow on February 27. He will give a talk at the JCC Free and Open for All between 6:30 and 8. Alon Vilan is a reporter for the IBA, the Israel Broadcasting Authority.
That's a government agency.
It's a government agency. It is sponsored by, you could call it a tax. Every Israeli is required to pay, I would say, around $250 a year that goes directly to the broadcasting company.
Huh.
And the government doesn't have control over that money.
I think that's my cable bill every month these days. But
yeah, that's like cable bill. And actually, if you are connected to the cables, you're paying it through the cables.
Through the cable, right.
But you need to pay it regardless. You know, if you have a TV set, you're not using it at all, you still need
you're
to pay that
tax.
You're still paying
the tax, right?
And it's interesting because that gives kind of free speech that is sponsored by the government, because the government doesn't have control about what do they say there.
No editorial control, but...
Exactly. On the other hand, there are a lot of debates. For instance, there is a new daily news magazine called Israel Hayom that was created by an American finance leader who is closely related to Benjamin Netanyahu. And that newspaper is being given for free for people. You don't need to pay. You don't need to buy it. You have people standing at the junctions and just handing it out for free. And it become very significant newspaper. And some would say, well, they have their agenda. He's very closely related to Bibi Netanyahu. On the other hand, some people will read Haaretz and say, well, Haaretz is very closely related to some very left-wing parties. Or Yediot Ahronot, which is the biggest
biggest circulation newspaper in Israel, right?
I would guess about 80% of Israelis read Yediot Ahronot. Right. And through the web, by the way, you can read it on Ynet. If right. you go to Ynet Israel News, you'll see it. And they're in some ways related to the Labor Party. So, yeah, there is politics and media, but at the end of the day, you do get free speech because you have varieties. You have Arutz Sheva on the far right end, you have Haaretz on the far left end, and you have everything in between.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the great parts about Israel is just everybody's got an opinion, and it's probably in print and online too. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, is this a Russian spring to match the Arab spring? This has sort of been an underreported story, but there have been gigantic protests in Moscow in the sub-zero cold against Vladimir Putin's continuing official, unofficial control of the Russian state.
Well, you know, to put it mildly, Russia is a strange place, and there's always been a very strong connection between Russia and its state apparatus and the fate of the Jewish people. I mean, at one point in the 1880s, a series of actions sponsored by the then Tsarist Russian state resulted in the greatest population movement of Jews since the destruction of the Second Temple.
Yeah, probably in pure numbers larger.
Right. I mean, roughly, I don't know, 5 million Jews, many of whom ended up in North America, Israel, Argentina, Australia. It was a huge shift in Jewish life and fortunes. Notwithstanding that, Russia still has one of the largest Jewish communities in the world, a very significant number.
Well, actually, even, you know, the million Jews who left Russia when the Soviet Union fell, and most of them went to, of course, some came to America, most went to Israel. So another huge population movement in Jewish history, not quite of the same epic proportion, yeah. But gigantic.
Yeah, but notwithstanding all
right.
those movements,
there's still a lot of Jews there.
The Holocaust, notwithstanding the gulags, notwithstanding
Stalin,
the purges of Stalin and all that. There's still a lot of Jews there, and right. they are disproportionately represented in the arts, in finances, in big business, et cetera, et cetera. So they're very visible and often targeted by a population that is still fundamentally anti-Semitic. Sort of folk wisdom, quote unquote, doesn't change quickly. And this is combined with a deep ambivalence among Russians about whether they really need to be ruled with an iron hand and they're really not capable of democratic self-rule and power sharing and compromise, or if they can move towards a civil society characterized by greater amounts of basic freedoms and greater participation and greater transparency, accountability, etc., on the part of the government. So when you talk with Russians today, especially anybody over 40 or 50, there's a certain amount of nostalgia for the good old days when they had fewer choices. And there's even nostalgia about Stalin overlooking all the horrible things he did, or recognizing it and saying, yes, but those things were necessary at the time. If only Stalin were back today, life would be much better. And there's a significant number of Russians who feel that way. On the other hand, there's a growing number of younger Russians, and not necessarily teenagers, but people, let's say, under 40 or even under 50, who see the changes that are possible with greater democracy and a more of a market system and less state, less role for the state, and who embrace those changes, who see the West as a model, and who resent the authoritarian sort of kleptocracy that was created by Putin and his cronies, and they particularly don't like the prospect of 12 more years of holding back the tide of history and preventing change. So you have these two competing forces, and how that's going to play out is something that we should talk about next week. Is there a relationship between the Russian Spring and the Arab Spring? I certainly think so, and that's another thing we can talk about on a future show.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week. Continue this.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a Public Service. Rabbi Gold is taken ill and is admitted to the hospital. The next day, Max, the temple's president, goes to visit him. Rabbi, says Max, I'm here on behalf of our board of trustees. They've asked me to bring you their good wishes for a speedy recovery and their hope you should live to be 120. Thank you, says Rabbi Gold weakly. I'm pleased to hear of their good wishes for me. And so you should be, Rabbi, says Max. It was close, but the final vote was 11-9. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week, we read the Torah portion of Titzaveh in the Book of Exodus, a ritually-oriented parsha which gives the commandment to create a ner tamid, an eternal light, for the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was the first sanctuary of the people of Israel, although technically speaking, the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was a very elaborate portable tent, somehow appropriate on rodeo weekend. It was also the place where God's presence in the form of the Shekhinah resided. In a sense, that's where God lived, or more accurately, since God is everywhere, it was where God was most available. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week, we're told that there should be a continual fire, a ner tamid, a constant light burning on the altar, a sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not God. We must build the altar and the fire and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. And if you have ever kept a fire burning around the clock, say at a camp out or a bonfire or for heat on a cold winter's night in some frigid clime, you know just how much fuel you need to do it. You're always either stoking it or bringing in more wood for it to burn. If neglected for any length of time, it burns out. The Ner Tamid was not just a symbol, but a process requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our own spiritual lives are rather like that ancient Ner Tamid, the eternal light. If we wish God's presence to illumine our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, then we too must feed our own Ner Tamid, must gently and regularly add spiritual fuel to the flame, so to speak. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, blessings, personal and communal rituals, time to breathe and allow God into our lives. All of these help feed the fire, and they must be done with some regularity, or our own internal, eternal lights will go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or grand the temple. While today we simply pay the electric bill to keep it alive, even that requires active participation. But its symbolic purpose is much greater. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us that God is with us always, if we take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, author Deborah Feldman, will continue with her dramatic story about the choice to leave the Satmar Hasidim and the price she paid when we return here on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Two funny stories and one serious one today. First, Rabbi David Lazar is a most unusual rabbi. Currently rabbi of Stockholm's Jewish community in Sweden. They have a gorgeous great synagogue there, by the way, where he's the rabbi. A very neat place to enjoy a summer Friday night service when it doesn't get dark until after midnight. Anyway, Rabbi Lazar has been named Sweden's Heterosexual of the Year by a magazine of the LGBT community. I am not making this up. This is Lazar's second such award. While still a pulpit rabbi in Israel, this American Ole, an immigrant to Israel, was named to a similar honor by the LGBT community in Tel Aviv. I could probably be in the Guinness Book of World Records, chuckled Lazar. I'm the only rabbi with a gay award on two continents, and I'm straight. A leading conservative rabbi in Israel's Masoreti movement, Lazar has advocated strongly and effectively for full human rights for gays and lesbians. As he says, every human being was created in the image of God. Nobody is abnormal. Everybody is part of normality. Lazar felt he should make every effort to attend the ceremony, and the father of five brought his wife Sasha, too. I realized that if I get this award, Heterosexual of the Year, I'd better look the part and show up with a woman. Mazel tov, Rabbi Lazar. In other countries in the Middle East, viral Facebook protests revolve around regime change, freeing tortured political prisoners, or full-scale revolution and civil war. Ah, but in Israel, viral Facebook protests revolve around the price of cheese, or, last week, chocolate. The CEO of the food consortium Strauss Israel, Zion Ballas, responded to a new Facebook set of protests last weekend involving a photograph that showed a Pesach Zman candy bar, that means time out, by the way, in the U.S., costs only 69 cents, but it's $2 in Israel, and it's made in Israel. We did everything we could to lower prices, Ballas said. I hope the public understands that. The cause for the price difference, according to him, are special Purim sales in supermarkets in Jewish communities. This is, however, a change from his previous explanation when he claimed that retailers in the U.S. promoted certain products because they had a surplus. However, consumers then posted photos on Facebook proving that the prices are very similar to prices of U.S.-manufactured non-kosher chocolate bars. The Israeli chocolate was also being sold in an Arab-owned supermarket at the same lower price. It is rather unlikely that an Arab supermarket would be running Purim sales. In addition, the items were not marked as being on sale. Aha! A spokesman for Strauss explained that after the social protest last summer in Israel, prices of over 50 products were lowered to the minimum, and additional cuts are not planned. Darn it. According to the statement, consumer prices are set by retailers outside the company's control. The chairman of the Knesset's Economics Committee, Carmel Shamaha Cohen, initiated an urgent discussion on the differences between local and export prices of Israeli products. I will summon Strauss management to the committee to investigate why the prices of products are cut in half when exported to foreign markets, he said. On such major issues as the price of a candy bar are Israeli controversies rooted these days. Well, an extraordinary rabbi died recently. W. Gunther Plaut was an exceptional man whose vast, scholarly, and ardently contemporary edition of the Torah has helped define Reform Judaism in late 20th century North America. He died at the age of 99. At his death, the elder Rabbi Plaut was still the senior scholar at Holy Blossom Temple in Toronto, where he had served as senior rabbi from 1961 to 77. One of the most prominent rabbis in the whole world, Rabbi Gunther Plaut wrote more than 20 books on Jewish theology, history, and culture. He was best known, however, for the Torah, a modern commentary, his magnum opus, published by the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the umbrella organization for the Reform Jewish movement in North America, now called the Union for Reform Judaism. First published as a single volume in 1981 and issued in a revised edition in 2005, Rabbi Plaut's Torah has become a touchstone for Judaism's liberal branches. While Jews have long studied Torah, you know, always, with the aid of rabbinical commentaries, none like Plaut's had ever before appeared. God is not the author of this text, Rabbi Plaut wrote in the volume's introduction. The people are, but God's voice may be heard through theirs if we listen with open minds. The Plaut Torah has sold nearly 120,000 hardback copies. It is used today in almost all Reform synagogues, as well as in some conservative and Reconstructionist ones throughout the world. This is the first non-Orthodox full commentary on the Torah published in English for congregational use. Rabbi Danny Freelander, Senior Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism and a former guest of Two Jewish, said, before the Plaut Torah, the commentary most widely used in North American synagogues across the Jewish spectrum was by Joseph Hertz, the chief rabbi of Britain. Published in the 20s and 30s, Rabbi Hertz's commentary was written from an Orthodox perspective, and as such, it considered the Torah the word of God, given to Moses on Mount Sinai. The Hertz Torah represents a point of view that is now unacceptable to many, Rabbi Plaut told a Toronto newspaper in 1981. Furthermore, it was written at a time of growing anti-Semitism when Hitler was coming to power, so it's highly apologetic. Its language is magnificent, but Jews today are entitled to be given insights that go beyond the traditional. Drawing on scholarship in science, biblical archaeology, Near East studies, folklore, linguistics, feminism, and non-Jewish texts like Shakespeare, the Quran, and the New Testament, the commentaries in the Plaut Torah ascribe layers of possible meanings to the Torah. This makes probing, analytical discussion, and argument among worshipers not only possible, but often satisfyingly inevitable, and so Jewish. Plaut used critical scholarship, was open to it, in a book that was going to sit in the pews in synagogue, said Richard Elliott Friedman, the Ann and J. Davis Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Georgia, and another former guest of Two Jewish, which the conservative Jews, forget the Orthodox, weren't even doing then. It was a real mark of a return to tradition on the one hand, with a definite liberal sensibility on the other, said Rabbi David Ellenson, president of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, yet another former guest of Too Jewish, he was able to combine a reverence for tradition with modern ethical and aesthetic sensibilities. Long considered the de facto leader of Canadian Jewry, Rabbi Plaut was for decades a well-known public figure throughout Canada. He wrote and spoke often to ecumenical audiences on a range of religious and human rights issues, in particular the rights of refugees. Rabbi Plaut did not set out to be a rabbi or any kind of a clergyman, but the Nazis made that decision for him. Born in Munster, Germany in 1912, his parents ran a Jewish orphanage. Plaut was reared there with the other children. The young Plaut earned a Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Berlin in 1934, but because of the Nazis, could not practice. He spent a year in Berlin studying Jewish theology, one of the few fields still open to Jews. I wanted to know what it truly meant to be a Jew, if I was going to suffer for it, he said. In 1935, he was awarded a scholarship to study for the rabbinate at the Cincinnati campus of Hebrew Union College, and he took it, a decision that may well have saved his life. His parents, after ensuring that the children in their orphanage were safely placed, were able to flee to the Isle of Man and came to the United States after the war. Though Plaut thought his studies at the seminary would be simply a way to mark time until the war ended, Torah grabbed me, he said. He was ordained in 1939. One of the signatures on his smicha as rabbinic ordination is my grandfather's, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan of blessed memory. Plaut became an American citizen in 1943 and joined the U.S. Army immediately. Serving as a chaplain with 104th Infantry, Rabbi Plaut took part in the liberation of the Dora Nordhausen concentration camp in Germany. Though the survivors were starving, Plaut recalled, they did not ask for food, but for Jewish religious items. After the war, Plaut held pulpits in Chicago and St. Paul before taking up his longtime post in Toronto. A past president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the Canadian Jewish Congress, he was named an officer of the Order of Canada. Plaut's other books include the Haftorah commentary, the Magen David, how the six-pointed star became an emblem for the Jewish people, and two volumes of memoir. In 1935, shortly after he came to the U.S., the future Rabbi Plaut received an eloquent lesson in textual interpretation. Maybe it helped him later in his Torah commentary. Newly arrived in Cincinnati, he was shown an article in the sports section of a local newspaper by his fellow seminarians. A German Jew, he glanced at the headline, recalling years later, he thought the article was about a revolution in Italy. The headline said, "Reds Murder Cardinals." Well, I have a very fond memory of both discussing my grandfather with Gunther Plaut and playing tennis against him at a Union for Reform Judaism biennial convention in Orlando, Florida in 1999. He must have been in his mid-80s by then, but he could still place the ball very dramatically anywhere he wanted to. A remarkable, brilliant, funny man. May Gunther Plaut's memory continue to bring blessing, as his scholarship does daily all around the world. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Deborah Feldman. She's the author of Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, a memoir which has been kind of a, within the Jewish world, publishing sensation. A fascinating story. You describe your upbringing in among the Satmar Hasidim, who are among the Hasidim who reject modernity the most. If all Hasidim, to one degree or another, reject many modern qualities, the Satmar also reject, for example, the State of Israel because it wasn't created by the Messiah. Were you aware of sort of how different being a Satmar Hasid was growing up?
Actually, yes, I was. And I have to tell you, I always felt like an oddity, even within the Jewish community. I felt very certain that any other Jew would not accept me or want to know me. I even knew that there was a gigantic difference between me and the Lubavitch sect, which run the Chabad missions, because Satmar and Chabad had had this long-standing feud over the fact that the Lubavitch were pro-Israel and were messianic, and the Satmar were anti-Israel and anti-messianic. And so I already knew that Satmar had isolated itself from the rest of the Jewish community, and they called all outside Jews non-Jews. If you weren't Satmar, they didn't consider you Jewish. And when I first started reaching out to Jews outside of the Satmar community, I was very surprised and hurt that very few people wanted or had any interest in talking to me or accepting me, because there is something of an attitude of we don't want to be associated with them, that they give us a bad name. And what happens is that has direct consequences for anyone who wants to try a different kind of Judaism. because I tried to go to Chabad and ask for help, you know, and put my son into a Chabad school, and they were very, very unwilling to sort of have to deal with me and this issue of what do we do with a Satmar runaway? Like, we don't want to get our hands dirty. We don't want to be associated with it. And so they made it rather difficult for me, and I had to really make a lot of sacrifices and sort of pay the full fees. And they do charge a lot of money here in New York City because there are people here in New York who are willing to sort of pay a lot of money for their kids to be in a, you know, Jewish-run school, because I think they sort of feel guilty about not providing more of that at home. And so they put their kids in Chabad school. And the Chabad, you know, here in Manhattan, they do very good business with those people. But they didn't want to take me because they saw me as someone who had sort of left their original place. And they were like, well, why do you want to leave Satmar? Why can't you just put your son into a Satmar school? And I couldn't get it across to them that I wanted more for my son. I wanted him to have a high school diploma. I wanted him to have a future. And people just seemed very unwilling to deal with me. And I had the same attitude with the modern Orthodox Jews up until I think I sort of got to conservative and reform. And that's where people were just much more open and much more welcoming to me. But it certainly was frustrating dealing with that. And it really made me understand just how different and how marginalized the Satmars are.
So, Deborah, there were other reasons why you left your background. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I had a difficult marriage, to say the least. I was married for 5 years. And that marriage was arranged. I didn't enter into it by choice. And I was certainly not ready. I was very young. And I certainly, I wasn't ready for sexual activity. I had no desire for it. And I was forced into it by my family, which today shocks me, but then seemed very natural. And I spent a sort of a year struggling with that, really, really just not wanting to be in that place and not ready as a young woman. And even after I managed to, you know, get pregnant and satisfy everybody because I was finally producing progeny, I was felt very trapped and very much like I had no voice and I didn't matter. And the only thing mattered was that I produced children. And that reminds me of just how women who are infertile are treated so badly in the community and really are told that they have no value because they can't create children. They become very unhappy. And so I was sort of technically, you know, pregnant, satisfying everybody. Everybody just finally left me alone. And I was so scared because I kept thinking, I'm going to bring a child into this life. Who am I? Like, what right do I have to force this kind of life on a kid? Like, it's one thing if I have to live it, but I felt horribly guilty all the time as the child was growing inside me, thinking, this is all that I can offer it. And when my son was born, I was so struck by that responsibility of being a mother, and I could not fathom, I could not face, you know, giving him the life of a Satmar Yeshiva student, you know, who could barely read or speak English, who had no chance at getting a higher education or landing any sort of job, who had no chance at real, you know, self-expression or fulfillment. Just someone who was going to be another, you know, scholar in the ranks, you know, someone to be part of the numbers. You know, we're just numbers. You know, let's get bigger and bigger and stronger, but like individuals don't matter as long as we follow the rules. And I just couldn't see that life for my son. So, in a way, me getting out and getting educated was about giving him a better life. And now, you know, it's amazing the transformation that has taken place in him, because when I left, he had just turned 3 years old, and he had gotten his payas, which I sort of shortened later because they were very long and I wanted him to fit in. And I taught him English when we left because his first language was Yiddish, and he only spoke Yiddish. And he learned English in 3 weeks. By 3 weeks, he was fluent. And I put him into this, you know, wonderful traditional Jewish day school, you know, with a very diverse Jewish community. And he just thrived instantly. He became such a happy child. And he suddenly developed all these interests. And, like, he plays sports, which, you know, is not allowed in the community. The boys don't play sports. And he has all these amazing friends who come from very different families and different backgrounds. And he's learning Hebrew. And he's learning about Israel. And so, you know, he's doing so remarkably well, and he makes me so proud and so happy. And so just by looking at him, I feel like everything I did was worth it.
You are living a very different life. Do you still have contact with any of your family?
The only person I talk to my family is my mother.
Who also left the summer.
She left. She's gay. She lives in Brooklyn. We have slowly, you know, rebuilt our relationship. It's been hard, but I think we're getting to be in a really good place. She's really bonded with my son, which is very cool. They have an amazing relationship. They seem to really connect, and it's so great to be able to give that to my son. So I'm very happy about that. And I really think that we're going to end up being a very strong family unit because we're really working hard and building a strong relationship.
The community you left is not exactly legendary for its tolerance of any variation. It's not as though they're going to take revenge, but is the response simply to just cut you off and pretend you never lived?
Oh, no. The response has been actually very virulent, which surprises some people because technically speaking, they're not allowed to have any access to internet or TV, but they all seem to be online, you know, ranting and raving, in Aramaic and Hebrew and Yiddish. And there have been like sort of incitements to murder me that I've seen online. And, you know, luckily I understand most of it because I can read those languages. And it's certainly been extremely violent. And I know there's a protest planned for my reading tonight. I'm going to be reading in a bookstore in New York City. And as far as I know, there has been a protest planned for a week now for people to show up and try to discredit me. And I know the rabbis have sort of issued warnings for people not to attend because I don't think they want this kind of media attention. But unfortunately, there are plenty of extremists and fanatics in the community who don't care about, you know, how the media perceives them. And they don't care about how any other Jews perceive them. They just want me dead. They want me gone. They can't stand the idea of a woman, you know, finding the sort of guts to speak out. I think it's offends their sense of power. I don't know. I mean, it's been sort of even baffling to me.
So clearly they know about the book, and undoubtedly the response is actually selling more books, I would think, and gaining more media attention.
Unbelievable.
It's maybe not so unbelievable, but it certainly is counterproductive on their behalf.
I agree.
Here's a question you probably can't answer completely, but how many of the women and the girls you grew up with, the women that you know within the Satmar community, would leave if they had the courage to do so?
Basically, you know, I've gotten a request for help from a lot of women, and I've gotten sort of letters of solidarity from women. And so I know there really are women in the community who are too scared to speak out, but do support me. And you know, and I have nothing but compassion for these women, and I really do hope to be able to help them. And I'm currently working with a very, you know, high-profile organizations right now to start a shelter and to get a group of lawyers together and really offer these women the resources they need if they do want to get out. On the other hand, there are plenty of women who, you know, have sent me very angry letters. And the weird thing is, I really do understand these women, because 6 or 7 years ago, I was that woman, and I would have lashed out in the same exact way. And the reason I would have lashed out is because if someone said these things about my life, that would mean I would have to face the truth about my life and see it that way. And I wasn't looking to admit that my life was that bad. I was looking to justify it because leaving was too scary for me. I was too afraid. And so I thought I would have to stay. And I was looking for ways to make it seem less terrible. And if someone had stood up and said the things I'm saying now, I would have felt absolutely awful, and I would have felt very angry. And so I think these women have every right to lash out at me. And I have nothing but compassion for them as well.
You know, it's funny. I actually attended a Hasidic cheder for a couple of years, not Satmar.
How was that?
Well, it was interesting. In fourth grade, the boys and girls learned together. In fifth grade, they were separated.
Doesn't sound like any cheder I know.
Yeah, it might have been a little bit left-wing for a Hasidic cheder. And then the girls went off to a Beis Yaakov, and the boys...
But isn't a Beis Yaakov tradition-oriented in the Litvish community,
not,
as far as I know?
Well, this is a little more complicated. Well, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, which is a very different
world. Of course.
But I will say that within that community, the girls pretty much stopped learning intellectually at about fifth grade or so.
And yeah, so that makes sense.
The best students might have all been girls, but by the time we were separated for a few years, none of them had really advanced because they really weren't given any more opportunity.
How unfortunate.
That's what I thought, and it certainly didn't... endear the ultra-Orthodox community to me. But that certainly would have been true for the Satmar Hasidim. And isn't it sort of the case that what really brought you out of that world was the library?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that place saved my life. I don't know what I'd been without that place. I mean, it was the only happiness in my life as a child.
I want to thank Deborah Feldman for a fascinating visit on Too Jewish. Her book is called Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, a memoir. And you can find it online and everywhere books are. Deborah, thank you for a great visit.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock when our guest will be actress Mayim Bialik, once known as Blossom on TV and now best known as Amy Farrah Fowler on The Big Bang Theory, and also a PhD biologist and a returning guest on Too Jewish who attended our Kabbalistic services at my congregation here in Tucson last Shabbat, by the way. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and please like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning for Rodeo Weekend comes from another Jewish cowboy, the frequent Too Jewish guest, Kinky Friedman, and his classic, They Ain't Making Jews Like Jesus Anymore. My friends, have a great day, a fine end to Rodeo Weekend, and a Shavuot Tov, a week we pray of peace.
Well, a redneck nerd in a bowling shirt was a guzzling Lone Star beer. Talking religion and politics for all the world to hear. They ought to send you back to Russia, boy, or New York City, one. You just want to doodle a Christian girl and you killed God's only son. I said, has it occurred to you, you nerd, that that's not very nice? We Jews believe it was Santa Claus that killed Jesus Christ. You know you don't look Jewish, you said, near as I can figure. I had you lamped for a slightly anemic, well-dressed country...